Hey everyone, I'm Jason V, and this is Local Color, a Baltimore podcast, putting the spotlight on Baltimore's culture creators. My guest today is Darius Wilmore of Taharka Brothers Ice Cream. The social enterprise launched in 2010, serving the community, quote, socially sourced ice cream and sorbets made from radical recipes. We're going to talk about the documentary about the company, A Dream Preferred, and why they believe owning and running a business is the key to success. Darius, welcome to Local Color.
Hey, thanks for having me, brother.
Sure, no problem. How you doing today?
I'm hanging in there, man.
Let's just jump in, man. Why ice cream?
That's a good question. It was an accident, like many things often are, or seemingly so, right? Taharka Brothers, a long time ago in the early 90s, had a cafe. They wanted to get into the ice cream business because they thought it would be fun. Ben & Jerry's wasn't opening any franchises at the time in the city, if I'm recalling the story correctly. So they decided to try it on their own, and they got really good at it, started winning awards for it. One thing led to another as the company evolved. So did the mission and the goal and all that stuff, you know, just kind of came with it as it moved forward. But, you know, you can't be mad at making ice cream. It's like, you know, I mean, it's work, but it's ice cream, man.
Everybody loves ice cream.
Yeah, you can't be mad. You can't be mad at it, man. So it's crazy, you know?
Tell me about the Kickstarter campaign for Sojourner, a.k.a. the Changemaker Mobile, and why did you guys name it that?
Every business needs capital. We needed capital. We didn't have a retail. We don't have a retail presence. We used to. Well, the Uncle Wiggly's is today. That used to be at Taharka Brothers shop. It was Taharka Brothers for about 7 years. And but we got out of the retail business. We had to make some decisions in terms of.
I don't mean to cut you off. That is one of my questions. We can get to that, but for now, could you
just talk about the truck?
Yeah,
sure. We needed a truck. We needed something that would allow us to be out in the community, touching people and interacting with people. That could also be a business vehicle as well. Food trucks had just a few years earlier been blowing up on the scene, you know, and we thought that would be a really great way to kind of kill two birds with one stone. But we didn't have the capital for it. All our capital is wrapped up in the manufacturing facility. Enter Kickstarter to raise the money, and we thought we might be able to pull it off. We had been doing some different things, different events and so forth, and have been getting a bigger and bigger following online and social media, and people coming out to these events. So we thought we had a groundswell of supporters. Of course, we had the customers who buy it, but it's one thing for a customer to buy a pint and then for you to ask them for something else. You know what I mean? It's not always guaranteed that that's going to transition from one product into the other in terms of being a paying customer. So we weren't sure about that, but we thought at least we had a small core of people that were really beginning to really kind of vibe with us and might be willing to kick out for the Kickstarter. So we tried to make that happen, man, and we were able to successfully do it. So the idea for the truck was to be a community engagement vehicle that we could use to kind of go out, promote different events, book authors, films, and really talk to the community about human rights, social justice, civil rights history, local stuff that we felt was pressing in the community that people needed to know about and talk about, and things that we wanted to promote to people that we thought they should look into or maybe participate in and be a part of. So that's kind of what the truck was about. And Sojourner, a sojourn is a short trip, you know, a short journey. So the trucks and automobiles take short sojourns when they go to places. And of course, what she did in terms of slavery and so forth and traveling the country with her work back in the day, it seems like it made sense to kind of nickname the truck that. And we had this idea that if we got other trucks down the road, we'd name them all different things, you know, Langston, you know, or, you know, Howard for Howard's Inn, things like that, you know, if we went along. So that was it.
The Kickstarter campaign to get funding for the Changemaker Mobile is also the subject of the documentary about you guys, A Dream Preferred. I watched the documentary and I didn't really see you in it. Why was that?
That was intentional. The idea was for the younger people to, and young can be relative, I understand that, depending on who you're talking to and who's in the room at the time. But most people that work at the company, it's about 12 people, and they're all about between the age of 17 and 25. So either about to be college age or master's degree college age. And I'm one of the oldest people there. And we didn't, you know, whenever we enter the picture, it changes the dynamic of the perception of what
when an adult enters the picture, you mean?
When people see us in the room, they assume that we're the ones pulling strings, calling shots, all that kind of thing. So we didn't want that to be the perception in the movie. Oh, well, okay, well, he must be the guy, or if it was Sean or someone else, Felton's in the movie. We'd rather that had not happened, but that was director's decision. They make the movie, so we just let him. But we fought hard to keep ourselves out of it, me and Sean. Would have loved to have been in it, though, but the values of what we're trying to do dictate that I gotta not do that.
You gotta step away.
Yeah, I gotta step away, you know? So I ain't mad at being in the movie, but so that was kind of the idea, to kind of step away so that the young people there could kind of be the stars of the film. So that's kind of where that why I was not in it. Although I'm briefly in there for a few seconds and a few scenes, and that's fine. But if you blink, you'll miss me. They're young people, so obviously the learning curve, the whole life learning curve, is just beginning for them, right? So they really can't see around corners that I've already been around, you know, and I already know what's coming, you know.
Well, how old are you?
I'm 43.
You're 43?
Yeah.
Yo, I thought you were like 31 or something.
No, thank you. You made my day even better now.
Yeah.
You made it even better.
Yeah, man. When you were coming in, I saw you. I was like, man, I just can't tell how old this guy is. Wow.
Well, you made my day even better now.
No problem. It's not, I'm not
thank
lying.
You. Thank you. So obviously, you know, me and some of the other people there are older. Someone's got to make sure the train kind of stays on the tracks and kind of see when the train might jump off. And the young people there don't have the experience to do that. So that's why you need some older people to be there. But as much as we can stay out of that, we do. It's the young people that do make the deliveries. When you call, there's usually Whitney's usually answering the phone. Whitney's maybe 23 now. She started when she was maybe 19. Kofi makes the ice cream. I think he's 23 now. He started when he was 19. Mike helped makes the ice cream. They're all 18, 19, 20, 21. I don't tell them what to do.
So you're hands off until you need to be hands on.
That's right. Right. Because the idea and the business model warrants that type of kind of integrity. And if we don't do that, then we don't have the credibility, and it's not real. It's got to be real, or else we're all just kind of, you know, faking the funk, you know, and we don't want to do that. When we say that they run it, they run it, and that it has its perils, you know. But you know, that's just the way it's got to be, you know.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that's why I wasn't in the movie.
I want to talk about a scene from the documentary. Employees were handing out flyers for the Kickstarter campaign. I think it was in front of Uncle Wiggily's.
Mm-hmm.
One employee tried to hand a flyer to a woman, and she acknowledged him and then kind of awkwardly like ignored him and then squeezed by him without saying anything. And then the employees got understandably upset and talked about calling it a day and about how people were being rude to them.
Mm-hmm.
Then a black guy with his back to the camera was giving the employees a pep talk about how black men are portrayed in media and how it's tough to shake that perception off. Who was that guy?
I don't remember the brother's name, but he was a part of the film crew. I could find out his name, so I'm sorry if he hears this. But he was a part of the film crew for that day. That scene is interesting because none of that was intentional. None of that was planned. What's crazy is that those customers would have been they're our customers. We had that shop for years, right? And Maurice, who was one of the guys who got really upset in the video, I think Vincent and Kevin were also some of the ones handing out the flyers. When we had that shop, Maurice used to work behind the counter. So those same people that brushed him off would have greeted him when they walked into there inside the counter. And he probably had served them for years before, because Maurice has been one of the longest ones been around for six, seven years now. So that wasn't planned. The directors wanted to shoot some scenes of us handing out flyers because we legitimately needed to raise the money, and we were going to our legitimate customers to get the money for the truck. So we were like, hey, why don't we go to Uncle Wiggly's? Our customers are there. They'll probably support this. We'll hand out the flyers and make this happen. So they go, okay, great, let's shoot it. And that's what happened. Those are our customers who did that. You know what I mean? It was crazy. And that's what really upset them so much, you know, because it's like, wait a second, man, if I was behind the counter, you'd be willing to talk to me. But because I'm here, outside, you won't speak to me or anything. So it was just a really crazy, it was a crazy thing. And I think it was worse than what it was on camera. Cause I wasn't there the day that was shot, but I heard about it and it was just like this crazy thing. And I was just like, what? It was crazy, man.
Yeah, I understand. You know? When I was, the part in the documentary, he was like, man, these people out here, like, they looking at us like we're trying to rob them or something.
Right,
and so
you're just
trying to hand out flyers and you're just trying to do your thing. You're just trying to do the same thing that everybody else is doing, but because you look or maybe talk a certain type of way, that perception of they have of you gives them pause when you really just, you're just trying to do your thing.
Right.
That leads me to another question. Do you find yourself being a mentor and sometimes even like a guardian of sorts to the employees?
Yeah, even though I try not to.
Why not?
Just because we kind of want them to. I may be painting with a broad stroke here, but brothers and sisters from the city have their own, and I may be stereotyping them as well in a positive sense, I think. They have their own energy, hustle. I'm out here in these streets. I got to make stuff happen. Internal motivations, internal initiative. You know, I used to work in the music business, you know, for a long time in New York City at record companies and rap record companies. And that energy was always there, you know, and those companies were set up. You know, the slogan was, and they meant it, the people that were running the companies meant it, make it happen. And you were giving a lot of leeway to make it happen. Whatever you need to do, just get it done. Try not to mess up, but get it done. And I think that kind of comes from that same type of energy of being out and having to make things happen, you know, because you really don't have no other, you know, option, you know, or maybe you think you don't have another option or you feel like you don't have another option. So I try to kind of stay away to help foster that make it happen atmosphere. But whenever there's a question that's asked, you know, or whenever I feel I need to do that, I'm happy to do it. And there's like this mutual, like, deference, right? So you want to pay deference to people that are older than you because they have the wisdom that you don't have. So you pay deference to that. Youth is deserving of an equal amount of deference as well. So I try to honor that and respect that and give and show deference to them at the same time, you know?
I'm listening to what you're saying and what mm-hmm. we were talking about on the phone before, and I'm just getting back to your age. And it's like, it's just blowing my mind.
Why?
I just thought that you were closer in age to me because I just turned 26 recently. So I don't even know how old you thought that I was.
I thought maybe you were 19 or something, man. You know, you said you were an intern, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe you're in school, maybe 20.
Oh, I had no
idea, you know?
No, I've been out of college. It'll be 5 years next year.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Man. I thought maybe you were 19, 20 years old, you know?
No, but just listening to how you talk and just your demeanor, you seem very relaxed and reserved. Is that by like choice or is that just who you are?
I think my dad, my sister are that way. So we're kind of like that. I moved to New York to go to college, and I was walking down the street coming home. We lived in Crown Heights, and she still lives in Crown Heights. And like I said, I had my headphones on. I was just walking. You know, people in New York, it's a, you know, and I love it, you know, but that never kind of got inside me, right? So she was like, I watched you walking down the block, and she was like, you know, you're just walking down the block, and everyone's flying past you by 100 miles an hour, you know. She was like, you know, you've been here for years, this has not affected you, you know what I mean? So it's like, that's just our way. And she didn't realize that she was just kind of the same way, and my dad was that way too, you know. So when I would get into cabs in New York, which people take a lot, maybe they're taking Uber these days, the drivers would oftentimes, didn't happen a whole lot, but it happened more than once, they would ask if I was from California. And it took me a while to figure out, like, why do they ask if I'm from California, man? And then I kind of figured it out because sometimes this Californians have this kind of laid back thing, man. But it was funny. I was like, why do they keep asking me? Why, you know?
It was a mystery to you.
Yeah, I had a fiance at the time, and I was like, you know, you know why they keep asking you? Why do you think they? I figured it out, man.
Oh, God. Now, are you from New York or from here?
No, I'm from Severna Park. I grew up out in, which is right sandwiched between Baltimore and Annapolis. So it's about 15 minutes from either Annapolis or Baltimore. And all my family's from Baltimore by way of the Great Migration in South Carolina, North Carolina, that kind of thing. Came up from during Jim Crow, trying to get out, escape Jim Crow. So, but I moved to New York in the early 90s to go to school and to work in the music business. And
where'd you go to school?
I went to what would be Micah's equivalent, I guess, the School of Visual Arts.
You know? Up in New York?
Yeah. So it's like Maryland Institute College of Art, but it's in New York.
Is that different from, what is it called? I think like the Parsons School, or like the new school at Parsons or something?
Parsons School Designs, dope design school, man. Damn it. Yeah, they're slamming. They're different, but they're not too far from one another. Yeah, Parsons is dope, man.
All right. Yeah. I'm assuming that you enjoyed your time in New York.
I loved it. Loved New York. So I've been going back and forth to New York since I was a child. My sister moved there since the 76, 75 maybe. She's twice my age, I think. I haven't asked her age. I'm gonna ask.
You don't want to get into that fight?
Yeah, you know what? I don't ask ladies. You don't even ask a lady their age, what they say. So, but from what I remember, she's about maybe 19, 20 years older than me. And she moved there in the 70s when it was like really crazy in New York and wild. And we used to go visit her. So I remember going to New York back when I was 6 years old, 5 years old, and older. But I'd go every year to visit. So I got to see all the stuff happen with hip hop and graffiti and breakdancing and all that stuff, man. From the 80s, you know, it just blew me away. So I've gone, been going every year for years. I'd go and stay a while, summer camp, that kind of thing. And you know, yeah. So I'm somewhat of a New Yorker, you know, maybe part time. Once was full time, but yeah. So I love New York City, man.
Over the phone, you told me that you guys have moved away from retail sales and mm-hmm. you guys do more wholesaling now. Why mm-hmm. is that?
Mm-hmm. Geography, the seasonality that comes from the weather changes, spring, summer, fall, winter. Around this time, sales start to plummet. A lot of scoop shops will close down around this time because they just can't sustain it. You know, the money's just not there because people aren't eating ice cream anymore in that way. You know, they'll buy it at a store and take it home, but they're not going to come to the scoop shop, get a cone. Although there are some who will do such things, but most people will not. And we need to figure out how to sustain the revenue, you know, and maintain it so that it was a year round business. And restaurants, you know, when there's enough of them, they're open every day and they order at least once a week. So we kind of decided we close the scoop shop down because it wasn't being managed and run well either. And that takes a lot of work to manage a retail shop, a lot of moving parts, you know. So we decided to focus on the wholesale business, thinking that we could grow that. And at the time, there wasn't this whole local thing that was happening. And this is like late 2009, early 2010. And the market was beginning to change, but it hadn't quite at that time. So it took a lot of knocking on doors to get people to try the product because, you know, it was a super premium ice cream. So it cost more to make. So you have to sell it at a higher price. It was a bit of a hard sell starting out. But then what happened was, the market started to change and people wanted more local stuff. And then that kind of worked in our favor because we're local and they were willing to spend a little bit more to get a local product. And that's kind of how that happened. That's why we went to the wholesale business. And I think it proved to be like the right thing to do. So we're in Virginia, DC, Howard County. We were up in Philly at one point, but they were coming down and picking it up. And I think over on the Eastern Shore, I think we had some account or two over there, but they were doing the same thing, coming in. They had a sister restaurant that was out there. They'd come in and take it. But yeah, we've expanded it pretty broadly. A bunch of colleges, Johns Hopkins.
Really?
Johns Hopkins University, Loyola University.
Any of the HBCUs?
No, and that is to our shame and hurt. That is to our sadness and shame, and we have attempted to do so, but it hasn't worked out. But we have
tried.
They
haven't been receptive to you, or y'all haven't reached out.
Oh no, we've reached out.
Really?
Yeah. It's interesting, man. HBCUs, some HBCUs, I speak for all of them, but the ones we reached out to, it's not so much that maybe they don't want to. They got to make the numbers work. For them, the numbers don't work the same way as a non-HBCU's numbers might work. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Kinda.
For them. Well, you know, if HBCUs don't have the kind of money, you know, or the type of financial wiggle room that, you know, a Johns Hopkins might have or Georgetown University might have, they got to watch what they're spending, the food costs and stuff, I'm assuming. These aren't conversations we've had with them. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm thinking it through, you know. And they got to be cautious. You know, so if you walk in the door selling, talking about, you know, you got a $32, $33, $34 tub that you want to sell them.
They can get it for $18.
Yeah, right.
They got to make the numbers work.
Yeah, they got to make the numbers work for them because they don't have the kind of resources that other colleges do that are non-HBCU colleges. So maybe that's a part of why it hasn't happened, you know. But yeah, we reached out to several of them, man, and we're still reaching out to today, literally today, to get some. We love the work with Morgan because they're right here. My sister went to Morgan, man. You know, I used to hang out on the campus when I first got my driver's license. we've had a great relationship with WEAA, the station over there as well. Over the past couple of years, they've been real supportive. So we're coming in and out of campus, you know, relatively often. Was just the other day, you know,
took the changemaker mobile. The changemaker.
No. We just rolled over there to do an interview for something. And but that is one of the things we like to do more of, having that vehicle on campuses and stuff as well, especially at Morgan. We miss Morgan's homecoming. We missed all the homecomings, you know what I mean? Whether it's Hampton, Howard, you know, we need to be up in these spots. Yeah, so it's a bunch of colleges. Georgetown, we did Georgetown for a while. Georgetown, American, Catholic University, all the busboys and poets in D.C., if people are aware of busboys and poets. And yeah, and Hopkins and Loyola and Micah, a bunch of places. So Phillips Seafood, I don't know if we still have Phillips now, but Phillips Seafood, a bunch of restaurants all around the city and in the county. So I say all I have to say that seemed to have worked out, going in that direction, going away from retail and then into the wholesale business.
Yeah. Can you tell me about some of the flavors, then the names of the flavors?
Yeah, sure. As Harker Brothers was evolving, a lot of conversations were taking place about, you know, what the company could be about, what it could represent, what direction it should go in, and so forth. And then the next thing became, well, how does it express that, right? Whatever values it's going to have. How do we make people aware of that? And then it was the next thing was, well, you know, you got to put it in the ice cream, right? I mean, that's the product that you're making, you know. And ice cream is one of these things where it's so malleable, it can morph and mutate into anything. And a lot of products just don't adhere to that type of manipulation as well as ice cream does. You can make almost anything in ice cream form. It's crazy. So we thought we'd start making these some flavors that kind of speak to some of the values and so forth. And we thought, well, you know, we could make flavors about people. You know, it could be someone making contemporary sense who may be making history right now, or it could be someone from the past who's already made history that we're feeling the effects of. Civil rights history, world human rights history, events that have taken place. You know, it doesn't have to be around a person. It could be an event. So with that being said, we've done a few flavors, and as a business, there's a business tug of war you got to do to kind of even make that happen, because most of our business is wholesale. So a lot of the restaurants buy vanilla, they buy strawberry, they buy chocolate, so that they can use them for the desserts. But a lot of these flavors are complex with a different ingredients in it, because you're trying to tell a story in flavor form, and you got to match the narrative with these ingredients, which means the flavors can have all these different things in them, and a restaurant pastry chef can't do anything with that type of flavor. So making them have been kind of like these one-offs. You know, we'll make them and then use them for an event or something. We haven't had a chance to really put them out into the marketplace like we'd like to. But we're planning on doing that though.
Speaking of making them for an event, you most recently collaborated with Everyman Theater on their new production of was it Fences?
Right. So yeah. So that's a good example of what we do. So they reached out to us to do. They have a new community engagement department over there, where they're trying to really engage the community with what they're doing. And so they're doing Fences for the second time. Second time they've done Fences. I think they did it one other time about 15 years ago. They were telling us, and they asked us to come up with a flavor that could kind of somehow interpret the play. And they charged us with that challenge. And we went to Pittsburgh for a couple days, stayed there, walked the streets. You know, visited August Wilson's former home. Walked to the places where he might have probably walked through, talked to people on the streets, visited with some people in their homes and talked to them about the history of the city and so forth. And, you know, it took a couple of weeks, you know, a lot of back and forth, and we were able to come up with something that was pretty interesting. And it's called Swinging for the Fences.
That's the name of the ice cream.
Yeah. We try to come up with interesting names. That can kind of, you know, be unique and so forth. And, you know, he was a baseball, the main character in the play was a baseball player, wanted to go pro, but Jim Crow kept him from that dream, but he was in the Negro Leagues. So Swinging for the Fences, you know, obviously double entendre, you know, literally swinging for us is a double meaning, swinging for the fences to knock them down, but then also swinging for the fences to hit a home run. Because fences can keep you in and keep you out. We all have some type of fences in our mind, or physical fences if you're in prison. So yeah, so flavors like that. We've done flavors for Cornel West.
What flavors were those?
The jazz man's blues. You know, he calls himself a blues man in the life of the mind, and a jazz man in the world of ideas. So we kind of took that and made a flavor out of that for him, which we got to sit down with him and have him try it, which is really cool. At Busboys and Poets, it was a blueberry ice cream with a blueberry and jasmine flower swirl in it. It's really good. It's a really good, elegant flavor. It's good.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's good. Sometimes you never know how it's going to turn out, you know. So we did one for Chaka Khan, and we did one for Fannie Lou Hamer, and we did one for Isaac Murphy, who was a legendary horse jockey. The Michael Jordan of his time period, apparently, when you read about him. We did another one for Langston Hughes, which is the movie is named after the flavor, A Dream Preferred, which is an ice cream flavor. And that is based off of the poem Harlem Dream Deferred.
The documentary is named after his poem.
The documentary is named after the flavor we made about our interpretation of that poem, Harlem Dream Deferred.
That's deep.
Right. So yeah, it's a little crazy. So we came up with this flavor because Busboys and Poets in DC have all these different event spaces, okay? And they're all named after different people. Langston Rooms, named after Langston Hughes. The Zen Room is named after educator and peace activist Howard Zinn. The Cullen Room is named after the poet County Cullen, writer County Cullen. So we had this idea where we were going to create a flavor for each of their locations that you only could get right there. Wherever that room was, that's where you get the flavor from. And that didn't work out. But we ended up making the first flavor, which was the Langston Hughes flavor, A Dream Preferred, anyway. And it was just a smash. I mean, it's one of the best flavors we probably have ever made.
What's
it's just
in
delicious,
it?
Man. So we had to go through the poem line by line. The idea was to go through the poem line by line and try to match an ingredient to any word or phrase that we felt could be turned into an ingredient, right? So what becomes of a dream deferred? Does it drop like a raisin in the sun? Well, raisins, you know? And then does it crust over like a syrupy sweet, you know? So syrup, crust, creme brulee, you know, you cook sugar, it gets hard, that kind of thing. There's no rotten meat in it, you know.
Unfortunately.
You're right. Couldn't figure that one out. So what we did was he loved candy. He loved candy from back in the day. And there's a particular candy bar, I forget the name of it, that he used to eat that they still make today. It's a Neapolitan coconut candy bar. And we make a really good toasted coconut ice cream. We make regular. We used to make regular coconut too, but toasted coconut is a little bit better. Toasting the coconut makes it takes it to another level. Anyway, we thought, well, we'll start there. He loved coconut candy bars, coconut ice cream. We'll start there, and then he went to Haiti, and Haiti makes a. He spent some time in Haiti. It's documented. I think Harvard has like an archive for his time in Haiti with writings and photographs and everything. And we spent some time in Haiti for this work we've been doing with chocolate and vanilla, and. So we all, oh, wow, okay, Haiti, wow, okay. So Haiti makes a really popular rum, Bobincourt rum. I might be saying it wrong. So we thought, well, okay, well, rum, raisin the sun, rum raisin, you know, Haitian rum raisin. He went to Haiti. So it ended up being a toasted coconut ice cream with Haitian rum raisin swirl. And... the last line of the poem is, or does it explode? So we had to figure out what to put in there so it makes something explode. And Pop Rocks explode when you put them in your mouth. Problem is, you know, the chemical reaction from saliva, you know, makes them pop almost immediately. But chocolate cancels out that reaction. So if you put chocolate covered Pop Rocks into milk, they won't pop. So only after you eat it and you start to melt away the chocolate, will they pop in your mouth? So the last line is, we ended up using chocolate Pop Rocks for the last line, or does it explode? So it's toasted coconut ice cream with Haitian rum raisin swirl and chocolate covered Pop Rocks with cooked sugar bits, like creme brulee sugar pieces.
Sounds like a complex flavor.
And people's eyes would roll back in their heads when they ate it, man. You know, yeah. It was crazy. We were like, yo, what? Yeah. Did you see that just happen? You see what they're at?
It was like crazy. To see the look on their face when they experience it?
Yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah. Especially something like that.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last question. How is Taharka Brothers changing the narrative about Baltimore and its residents?
That's a good question. I would say we had a speaking engagement at the Union Baptist Church today, with a bunch of people who didn't really know who we were. A few people there had heard of us, but none of them knew that Taharka Brothers was transitioning into a worker owner business cooperative. In the shadow of the events of Freddie Gray, I would think just on a business level, you know, the fact that you're attempting to give ownership in the type of ownership to a bunch of young black boys and girls who are from the same, some of them from the exact same neighborhood that went up in flames, changes a lot just by the doing of that and that being attempted, you know. And if it, and it's a profitable business, so it's running out of profit now.
Congratulations.
So, oh yeah, thanks. You know, a lot had to happen for that to happen. But so you have a bunch of young black people, right? Around the same age of a Freddie Gray, or the people that were young people that were out there protesting or uprising, you know, some months ago, owning and operating something that'll be legally theirs, that's a democratically run operation, you know, that alone changes, you know, the narrative, you know, in our own little way, I think. So that's part of the reason for that transition into it being a worker owner cooperative. It seemed like that was the best thing to do to kind of empower, and I hate to use that word, empower the young people that were working at Taharka Brothers, so that they can actually have ownership of it themselves, you know. So that's what I think, you know. And I can tell from the looks on people's faces when we tell them that. They're like, oh, snap, really? You know, really? You know, and some people aren't familiar with that type of work model either, you know? So some people, you have to kind of educate them a bit. But then people who are kind of familiar, like, wow, okay, that takes it to a whole nother level. Because it's one thing to kind of talk about social justice, economic justice stuff, and make flavors and stuff. You know, you can do that. But then to kind of economically...
walk the walk.
Yeah. And we were at a point where... you know, the idea of the people there having ownership was always a part of it. It was always the idea. but it was like that the it was about, well, how many stock options do they get? Can we do the stock option thing and get shares and that kind of thing? And your shares will vest, you know, over a period of years, and you can cash them in, that kind of thing. And, you know, we had some investors at the time, and they were putting in money, so they wanted to give up a piece of ownership too. So then how does it all work and all that? And all that just didn't fit where things were going in terms of value set, you know? Like, that whole conversation was just like, you know what? This shouldn't be the conversation. Stock options. Wait a minute. Didn't the country almost just collapse because of this?
To get away from.
Yeah, you're right. Right. Isn't that what we trying? People are trying to now try to figure out how to not. So why would we go that way? You know. And then aren't all these young people of color, you know, and black, you know, not just of color, black, and they probably couldn't get a job at one of those places that brought the country down anyway if they showed up or sent their resume in because their name sounds stupid. Like, all this, like, wait a minute, we should not be trying to bring that into this. We need to try to find some other way, you know? So that was also a part of it, you know, as well, you know? I could be wrong, but I mean, nothing's perfect. Nothing is a 100% answer, but, you know, just creating a, if you're going to talk about democracy and talk about human rights and stuff like that, then it would make sense. You got to have a democratically run workspace, you know, or at least try, you know. So that's kind of the attempt, you know. So we're not there yet. We're in the process of doing it. And that takes a bit of a while. We started talking about it a year ago. It had been something that had come up every now and then for about 5 years. And, you know, Tucker Brothers has been a moving train for years. So it was like, well, how do you do it? We don't know anything about it. How's it going to work? You know? And then last year, we decided to try to give it a real go. So it's been a year of a process, and there've been some people that have been helping us with it. But maybe in the next couple months, legally, it will be legally a worker owner cooperative, you know? And what happens is whoever works there signs their name, like their name gets added to the legal documents. That's how it works, you know? Like, you physically have to add the name, you know? So, which I didn't know that's how that works. I was, wow, really? Oh, that's crazy. If you have 50 owners, 50 names, you have to put each name on the and file it. So, and I think that'll probably be really important and really powerful. The young people there, you know, when they have to add the name and file it downtown, gotcha. You know what I mean? So,
gotcha. So. Well, I hope it all works out for you, man.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see, you know?
I want to thank Darius for sitting down with me today. To learn more about Taharka Brothers Ice Cream, find them online, TAHARKABrothers.com. You can also find them on Facebook and Twitter. Follow Local Color on Facebook, facebook.com/localcolorabp. And also follow us on Twitter, @localcolor410. Instagram is forthcoming. See you guys next time.